Om sahana bhavatu, sahana bhunaktu, saha viryam karavavahai, tejasvinavati tamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti.
We're on verse 51, chapter 7, 51. Going on with this. This is going to go on and on. This discussion.
Eight verses.
Aham brahmetya nulikya. Aham brahmetya nulikya. Brahmastitya mulikate. Brahmastitya mulikate. Paroksha jnana metanna, paroksha jnana metanna, brantam badha nirupanat, brantam badha nirupanat.
Sandeep. Aham, Brahma, iti, anulikya. Brahma, iti, anulikya. Brahma asti iti evam ulikhet. Did I see that? Brahma asti iti evam ulikhet. Paroksha jnanam etat na brantam Badha anirupanat. A lot of sandhi there. Now, if you remember in verse 50, in the previous verse where we ended last week, the argument is this. They're talking about, the discussion is about paroksha jnanam versus aparoksha jnanam. Paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge. Aparoksha jnanam, immediate knowledge. When the paroksha jnanam is there, is that paroksha jnanam valid? What type of knowledge is paroksha jnanam versus aparoksha jnanam? So in the previous verse it says, at the time of paroksha jnanam, paroksha jnana kalepi, at the time of the indirect knowledge, when that takes place, the vishyasva prakashata sama. The vishyasva prakashata is the same. Vishya Swaprakashata means the Vishya is Brahman. The Swaprakashata means the self-luminosity of Brahman. So when Paroksha Jnana is being given, the fact that Brahman is self-luminous, that is the same as in the Aparoksha Jnana. How is it the same that Brahman is self-luminous in Paroksha Jnana? He says, it's pretty obvious. He says, how is it the same? Remember the difference between the paroksha jnanam and the aparoksha. The paroksha jnanam would be Brahman is. Right? That's the indirect knowledge. That's paroksha jnanam. Brahman is. There is such a thing as Brahman. Okay? The aparoksha jnanam is I am that Brahman. Okay? So now this verse says, at the time of the paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge, the swaprakashata, the fact that Brahman is self-luminous, that is the same as in the aparoksha jnanam. How is it the same? He says like this. Brahma swaprakasham asti. Brahman, which is self-luminous, is. There is a Brahman which is self-luminous. It's indirect knowledge, right? But am I saying that it's not self-luminous? No. I'm saying, if I say that the Brahman that you are, even though you don't know it yet, that Brahman is self-luminous, and in fact, it is your very being. And when you gain the aparoksha jnanam, what do you gain? What do you recognize? Yes, I am self-luminous, and the Brahman that I thought was distant from me, in fact, is my very being. So if I say, there is a Brahman which is self-luminous, I'm not denying the self-evident nature of Brahman, even though at that time, you don't have direct knowledge of it. Still, the indirect knowledge says it is self-luminous. So he says, because of that, it's obvious. Okay, so now, but we're going to go further. So now he's going to discuss the validity again of this paroksha jnanam so that you don't think that the indirect knowledge that you're gaining is erroneous. So Vidyaranya is making a case for this. So he says in this now in 51, Aham Brahma iti, I am Brahman. Anulikya, having not known this, having not gained this knowledge, that I am the Brahman, Aham Brahma iti anulikya, having not gained this knowledge, still, he says, Brahma asti iti evam ulikate. One can know that this Brahman is, right? Not knowing I am the Brahman, I am that Brahman, having the aparoksha jnanam, still you can know in this manner there is such a thing as Brahman. There is Brahman. Okay? Then he says, paroksha jnanam etat. This is paroksha jnanam. This is indirect knowledge. The Shastra says there is such a thing as Brahman, and from Brahman all the whole universe has come. In fact, the Mandukya starts with that. In the beginning there was only Sat, right? In the beginning there was only Sat. From Sat alone all of this has come. Right? So, this is paroksha jnanam. And this paroksha jnanam is not brantam, he says. It's not an error. It's not an error to say that, even though it's indirect. It's not brantam. It's not an error, he says. Bhada anirupanat. He says it's not an error because of not seeing, not ascertaining any negation. There's no way to negate it. Now say if the Shastra says, the Upanishad says, there is Brahman, Brahman is self-luminous, Brahman is infinite. This is what the Shastra says now. What means of knowledge, and now it has to go on and show you that, that's true, but what means of knowledge do you have available to you to come and say, no, there is no such thing as that. Based upon what means of knowledge? See what I mean? So for you to negate the Shastra, the Upanishad that says Brahman is there, on what means of knowledge will allow you to do that? There is no such means of knowledge, and that's what the next verse says. Let me just a few sentences here before we get into the next verse. You know, if somebody says, if I were to say, you know, I have an elephant in my room, or let's make it smaller. You know, I have, and we use elephant for other things, so I'll do it a little differently. You know, I think that there's a cat sleeping on my bed. What if I say that? There's a cat sleeping on my bed. I think, so if I say, just so I'm not a liar, what if I say, you know, I think there's a cat sleeping on my bed. We can go and check on it, right? You can go to the room and you can check and see. And if there is, then yes. If there isn't, no. Right? But say, you know, if I'm saying something, there is something here or there is not something here, or there is something which is like this and not like this, and it's an object in the world, I'm giving you paroksha jnanam. Say I'm giving you paroksha jnanam of something. You can check up on it. You can bring your sense organs to it. You know, you can analyze it further. It's there to be analyzed, right? Because it's a thing. There's going to be a discussion here. Brahman is not a thing, right? Brahman is not a thing. There's nowhere you can go to check up on it. So in a way, as we get further into this unfoldment, in fact, in a sense, there is no such thing as paroksha jnanam, in one sense, of Brahman, because in reality, Brahman is by nature a paroksha. And so your recognition of it is going to be the recognition of something that is always has always been here. So how can you even have a paroksha jnanam of it? And if there is paroksha jnanam, how are you going to be able to check on it? It's only through a paroksha jnanam. See what I mean? Because it's not an object out here. that's available for you to go and bring your other your sense organs to it, or to bring some inference to it, or some presumption, or all of the other means of knowledge that we have available to us to go into the world and analyze it to see, well, is that Brahman really there or not? What will happen is, as you go in to analyze the world, first of all, Brahman's not an object to be there, so there's nothing that you can do about that. But there's no way to recognize Brahman in the world through any of the means of knowledge that you have available to you. The only way to recognize it is to recognize it as my very being. Right? Because you can't look at Brahman. See what I mean? And so the validation of the paroksha jnanam is aparoksha jnanam, not through some sort of sense perception. And so we don't have a means of knowledge available to us to go check up on this aparoksha jnanam, this paroksha jnanam of Brahman. The Upanishad has to do its job of revealing to us the aparoksha jnanam of myself. So this is where he's going. It's actually a really amazing kind of argument. So he starts out by saying, this is paroksha jnanam. You know, if I say that there is Brahman and Brahman is self-luminous, having not realized that I am that Brahman, the aparoksha jnanam hasn't taken place. So this is indirect knowledge. It's not an error. It's just indirect knowledge. Okay. Because there's no way, we say it's knowledge because we have no means to negate it. So we're going to call it paroksha now, and there's no way to negate it. The Shruti as Pramana is saying it. So let's look at, this is what he says in the next verse. Brahmanasti timanam chet. Brahmanasti manam chet syat badyet tada dhruvam syat badyet tada dhruvam nachayvam prabalam manam nachayvam prabalam manam pashyamo to nabadyate Brahma na asti iti manam chet syat badyeta tada dhruvam na cha evam prabalam manam pashyamaha ataha nabadyate. He says, first of all, in the previous line, he says, there's no way of negating it. We don't have any means at all. We don't see any negation of this. Then he says, if chait, if there was a manam, if there was a pramana, if there was some authority, some means of knowledge that says there is no Brahman, right? Some means of knowledge comes along, or some other authority, some other text, some other Shastra, some other Upanishad, something comes along and says, there is no Brahman, then, he says, if that should happen, bhajeta tada dhruvam, then he says, dhruvam, tada then, dhruvam, certainly, we could negate it. Because a means of knowledge is coming along that says, there is no Brahman, then we can negate it. He says, but then he says, nacha evam prabalam manam pashamaha. Pashyamaha, mi vahamaha, for the Sanskrit students. Na pashyamaha, we don't see any strong knowledge like that. We don't see any means of knowledge that has that type of prabala. Prabala means strength. What means of knowledge is there that can make that assertion that is strong? Prabala means strong. Is there any kind of means of knowledge anywhere, any authority anywhere that you know of that could say there is no Brahman, that there is no such thing as Brahman? He says, we don't see that. Therefore, agaha na bhajyate. Therefore, he says, it can't be negated. Okay? Of course, he has to say more than that, but this is the direction. Everybody with me so far? Now, just to give you a little, this is because I have a Bhasha here, so I can give you a little bit more of what Vidyaranya is trying to do here. He says that this is his argument. Somebody can doubt that this paroksha jnanam that is being given, because you're just saying that Brahman is, this paroksha jnanam that the Shruti is given here, because it hasn't become a paroksha for me, this paroksha jnanam with the statements of the Shruti, they could be erroneous. That's the problem that somebody's doubting. Like if the Shruti says, in the beginning there was existence alone, and from existence, from being pure being, this whole creation came. Talking about Brahman. They haven't yet revealed that Brahman to be myself. So, these Shruti statements, they could be wrong. They could be erroneous. And so now the question is, what would make them erroneous? And so he has four different ways that he's going to analyze how this could be erroneous. The first one is the one that we were just looking at. It's bhajyatvat. Because this paroksha jnanam is something that can be negated. Bhajya means you can just negate it. And then he says, in the verse that we've just done, how can it be negated? Through what means of knowledge, are you going to use to negate it? And really, if we were to, we could spend a long, long time just going down that track, looking at what is the sphere what we call the vishaya? What is the subject matter of every given means of knowledge? And what you end up with, if we go down that track, is that existence itself, if we say Brahman is existence or self-existent being, right? What means that we know that? Because every single person will say, I am, I exist. I am, I am, I am, I exist, I exist. The world is. We give isness being very generously to absolutely everything. So existence is a given, right? The existence is a given. But how are you going to establish it through any means of knowledge that you have available to you? The isness that I am, that I exist, is in fact aparoksha, right? In terms of experience, it's aparoksha. Because nothing is lighting up being, I just am. And I give that being to everything. But if I use my means of knowledge, like sense perception or inference that's based on sense perception, I can't find any existence. In fact, all I can find is that nothing here exists, really, because everything that I say exists is infinitely divisible into nothingness. Or I would say, that's wrong. It's infinitely divisible into something else. The isness never goes away, but I can never find the isness, right? So all of the names and forms are infinitely divisible. They all come into being, they go out of being, but the being remains. But I have no means of knowledge to comment on that being one way or the other. And the more I go at it with the means of knowledge that I have, all I end up doing is establishing mithya, that everything, the mithyatva, right, the apparent nature of everything that I perceive. But everything that I perceive, everything that I know within the box of the creation, enjoys, as a common denominator, is. Everything comes in and goes out of isness. So what does this mean? No means of knowledge that I have available to me can negate being, and also the pervasiveness of being. It can't touch it. It can't negate it. So that's not a reason for you to say that what the Shruti, which is considered as a means of knowledge, is saying to you. The Shruti is saying that Brahman is. and that Brahman is swaprakashita, that Brahman is self-evident being. It's pure existence. So these are the Shruti statements about Brahman. Brahman is self-evident being. Okay? So the self-evident being is not something that your sense organs can touch in any way or any means of knowledge that you have. And there is no shastra that's coming in and saying, no, there is no such thing. Okay? That's prabalam. Okay? That is strong. And so that being so, you can say, no, it can't negate it. That's not going to be a way of getting rid of this paroksha jnanam. It can't just dismiss it. Then you can say, the next argument is, well, if it's paroksha, then if we're giving paroksha jnanam, then we're not able to see it. Well, that's true, right? If it's paroksha jnanam, you're not seeing it. Like if I say, you know, if I describe something that I have in my room, you just have to trust that I'm an optapurusha, means I'm a sane person, and I'm saying, you know, I left my glasses on the table in the room. That's paroksha, you know. You're not seeing it at this time. And so that is enough to negate it, to make it erroneous, because I'm not seeing it. I can't. That makes it Bhranti. All right. So this is the argument. There's going to be four. This is the second one that he's going to deal with now. So let's read this verse.
Vyakya nuleka matrena, brahmatve swargadhirapi, brahmatve swargadhirapi, Branti syat vyakya nulekat, Branti syat vyakya nulekat, Samanyot leka darshanat, Samanyot leka darshanat. Vyakti anuleka matrena brahmatve swarga dihi api brantihi syat vyakti anulekat samanya uleka darshanat. He goes, vyakti means something is manifest. Like something is manifest right before you. The particular thing that it is there, right in front of you. That's vyakti. The actual form of it is there. So he says, vyakti anuleka matrena brahmatve. When you say something is erroneous or an error, merely, he says, matra means merely. Merely because of not seeing the actual thing in front of you. Is that enough to make it an error? You simply because you don't see it, does that make it erroneous? He says, if that's the case, then swargadihi api brantihi. Even the belief of the knowledge of swarga, the knowledge of heaven, swarga swargaloka, that also would be erroneous. So now, you have to put this back in the context. The Vedas, it's the Vedas that are talking about Brahman. The first part of the Vedas, and everybody within the Hindu containing myth, that everybody who's grown up within the Hindu containing myth, knows that there's Swargaloka, because the Vedas say there is. Swargaloka is heaven. It's one of the heaven worlds. That if you live a dharmic life and do the proper rituals and do all that is required, that is one of the lokas that you can attain to after death. And it's a high loka, it's one of the most exalted lokas, and it's a hard loka to get to. But that loka, it is, it's hard. There's so much ritual, so much tapas, so many things, austerities that are required to go to Swargaloka. But the Vedas say that Swargaloka is there, that heaven world is there, and it gives the means to get there. What rituals need to be done, what tapas needs to be done, what type of life you have to live. And if you do all of these things perfectly, then you can go to Swargaloka. Now, have you ever seen Swargaloka? No.
But the Vedas say there's Swargaloka, and the Vedas describe the Swargaloka and tell you how to get there. Okay. So now, what kind of knowledge do you have of the Swargaloka? He says, Vyakti Anulekat. Certainly you haven't seen it. You don't have this Vyakti. You're not seeing it right in front of you, manifest in front of you. So what is the kind of knowledge? He says, Samanya Ulekadarshanat. Because we're seeing that in this case, you just have a general understanding of what Swarga is. You have a general understanding of it. Right? You haven't seen it specifically. You don't think that doesn't make it an error for you. It's your paroksha jnanam of it doesn't become erroneous. You have Shraddha in the Vedas. The Vedas talk of Swargaloka. Right? You accept the Swargaloka is there, even though you have only a general knowledge of it. You would never think, oh, that's erroneous, just because you haven't seen it right before you, nor can you, right? So that's why they're using Swargaloka. But this argument also, it's the same as if somebody, you know, say they were born in London, in a small village near London, and they described it to you, and they described the house and how to get there, you know? Just because they're describing it to you in general description, they're giving you a general description of it, which is going to be quite a bit different than when you actually go there. So you travel to London and you go to the little village and you see it, and you see that house. You see the house you describe, well, that's exactly what they were describing. Right? So the paroksha jnanam that's being given to you is certainly not erroneous. It's a general knowledge of what would be specific, you will see specifically when you go there. The same in heaven. So they're describing heaven. It's general understanding they're giving to you. And when you go there, you say, oh, that's what they meant. Okay. You'll see it specifically, right? In the flesh, so to speak. Okay? So you would never call that Bhranti or erroneous. So now here, the same Vedas that are talking to you about Swargaloka. So you have to remember in India, everybody will believe in Swargaloka, just like everybody believes in reincarnation, in karma, in dharma, adharma, in punya, papa, that there are heaven worlds and hell worlds. Well, that's just simply taken for granted, like breathing. And so the Vedas that are talking about this Swargaloka, that you have a general knowledge of, are the same Vedas that are talking about Brahman. And so if you wouldn't call Swargaloka as erroneous or an error because it's paroksha, why would you call Brahman, which is paroksha to you at this time, why would you call that an error? Do you see where the logic is coming? You have to kind of transplant yourself into this type of a situation to see. Because they would definitely, the same Shastra that is saying Swarga, that they would definitely accept, that same Shastra is saying Brahman. So there's no, it's not about being an erroneous. The next possible error he's going to talk about is maybe more pertinent to us. How can you, this is the error he's going to bring up, how can we accept indirect knowledge, paroksha jnanam, for something that has the capacity of being by nature a paroksha? What kind of knowledge is that? How can I give you paroksha jnanam of something which is aparoksha? In other words, see the problem here? Brahman is already here. I already am Brahman. Brahman is already absolutely immediate as myself. That's the key to this though. Brahman is already present, already immediate. It's already swaprakasha, it's already manifest as self-evident being itself. If that is the nature of Brahman, where does indirect knowledge come in? How can there be such a thing as indirect knowledge? Like there can be indirect knowledge of a little house next in the village next to London, because that's away from me. So I can give indirect knowledge for that, and then you can go there and see it. But here, where's the indirect knowledge? Because Brahman already is the present, absolutely present. It's already a paroksha, immediate. So how does paroksha fit in here? How can you have indirect knowledge of it? Does it make any sense? So that indirect knowledge must be erroneous. In that way, it must be erroneous. See the argument? And so, ready? Aparokshatvayogyasya Aparokshatvayogyasya Naparokshamatirabrahmaha Naparokshamatirabrahmaha Paroksham ityanulekat Paroksham ityanulekat Artat paroksham asambhavat Artat paroksham asambhavat Aparokshatva Yogyasya na paroksha parokshamatihi brahmaha paroksham iti anulekat arthat paroksha sambhavat. It's paro- I didn't chant that correct, right? Paroksha sambhavat. Okay. He says paroksha matihi is the same as paroksha jnanam. Indirect knowledge, he says, na brahmaha. The indirect knowledge of what? Aparokshatva yogyasya. Of something which is capable of being known directly. Aparokshatva, being aparoksha, he says, yogyasya. Yogyasya means for that which has the capability, the capacity of aparokshatva, for that which has the capacity of being self-evident, of being known directly, this paroksha jnanam, he says, of that is na brahmaha. That's not an error. You can still have paroksha jnanam of that which is meant to be known as aparoksha. Aparoksha because it's already present. He says, no, you can still have. He says, you can still have that. It's not an error. Why? He says, paroksham iti anulekat. He says, let's see how to say this. This is interesting. He says, because it's not being known as paroksham. It's not being known as paroksham. Okay, so there's a couple of things here before we get to this last quarter. You don't, when you're talking about Brahman, Brahman is, what if I say like this? I'm going to describe Brahman, give you paroksha jnanam of Brahman. The Upanishads say that there is Brahman. Brahman is pure existence, which is self-evident, right? Pure existence, which is self-evident, which is the self-evident being, and which is the truth of your very self. So now what if I say, okay, the Upanishads reveal that I can say like this also, the Upanishads reveal that the self that you are is Brahman, and that is the self-evident being, which is the truth of this universe. So there's nothing here. Brahman is not being taught as paroksham. Your understanding is, in other words, I'm saying, it's like this. The Upanishads say that there is Brahman and that that Brahman is aparoksha. Now, is that paroksha Brahman being taught, which is being taught, am I teaching an aparoksha Brahman or a paroksha Brahman? If I say to you, the Upanishads reveal Brahman, which is your very self, and which is self-evident, and is aparoksha. This is what the Upanishads teach. That Brahman is, that's enough, you can say, the Upanishads teach that Brahman, and you know what the meaning of aparoksha is? The Upanishads teach that Brahman is aparoksha. Or the Upanishads, okay? The Upanishads teach that Brahman is yourself. And that self is self-evident. Right? That's paroksha jnanam I'm giving you. Right? Because you have to say, Oh, the Brahma, the Upanishads teach that? Please teach me. Right? Everybody knows the Mahavakya. What are the Mahavakyas? Aham Brahmasmi is a Mahavakya. I am Brahman. Tetramasi, you are that. Right? You are the Infinite Self, or you, O Jiva, are Ishwara. Right? Or Prajnanam Brahma, Brahman is consciousness. These are all the Mahavakyas. And so everybody knows the Upanishads teach the essence of the Upanishad are these Mahavakyas, Aham Brahmasmi, that I am Brahman. Please teach me, how is it that I am Brahman? Right? How is it that I am Brahman? Brahman is aparoksha. How is it that I am aparoksha? So here it says, what he's saying, paroksha jnanam, of what is to be known as aparoksha, that's not an error. Why? Because the jnanam itself doesn't teach it as paroksha. The paroksha jnanam doesn't teach Brahman as paroksha. Paroksham iti anulekat artat paroksham bhavat. So because what's happening, it's because of the possibility of being able to teach Brahman as paroksha by implication, right? Like if we say there's paroksha jnanam and aparoksha jnanam, we're implying the paroksha jnanam. There is no such Brahman which is paroksha. That doesn't exist. But the knowledge that you're gaining is paroksha, right? By implication, because you're not yet able to say, I am that Brahman. So if you can't say, I am the Brahman, I am Brahman, then the knowledge that's being given that is what? There is a Brahman, and that Brahman is a paroksha. So by implication, it's paroksha jnanam, not in reality, right? Because there's nothing removed from you to be capable of having paroksha jnanam of it. Everybody get it? Hang in there, here we go. Actually, this becomes really, really interesting. Now, what are we doing? He's got one other way, and then he's going to kind of pull this together. He says, okay, so you can't give that argument that because what is aparoksha can't be known through paroksha, therefore it has to be erroneous. You can't say that. Then he says, but what about this? It could be erroneous because I'm only perceiving a part of it. I'm only perceiving a part of it, you know? Like, for instance, this is what we'll get into. If you say there is Brahman, you can say, well, I can see how there could be Brahman, so I perceive that, but I don't perceive Brahman as me, right? So I'm perceiving Brahman as existence. I'm seeing that the Brahman is, but I'm not perceiving that I am the Brahman. Right? Brahman is, I know that, I understand that, I accept that from the Upanishads. So I'm perceiving a part of it. But I'm not perceiving that I am that. Right? So that's an argument. He says, okay, you're only perceiving, because you're only perceiving a part of it, therefore it's erroneous. Okay? This is going to become an interesting argument. Does everybody understand the argument? If I say, you know, if I'm only perceiving part of it, he's saying if you can only perceive part of something, then that makes it erroneous. So that's got some problems to it. So let's do this next one. Amsha grahitir brantis chet. Amsha grahitir brantis chet. Kata jnanam pramopavet. Kata jnanam pramopavet. Niramshasyapishamshatvam vyavartyamsha vibhedatah amsha agrahitehe brantihi chet ghatajnanam brahmaha bhavet iramshasya api samshatvam vyavartya amsha vibheditaha. He says, chet means if. If it is Bronte an heir, Bronte he chet. Why? Amsha agrahite, because you don't perceive part of it. You say that something becomes erroneous knowledge because you're not perceiving part of it, right? There's something you're not perceiving when you're looking at it or something. You don't perceive part of it, and so your knowledge is erroneous. He says, if you say that, then he says, gata jnanam brahmaha bhavet, then the knowledge of a pot would be erroneous. Like, for instance, see, look, if I hold this up to you, they actually describe all this in the Bhasha. Say, I'm holding this up to you. You don't see the back of it, do you? Because you can't see around to the back. So you're only perceiving a part of it. Therefore, what you're perceiving is erroneous. Your perception here is erroneous because you're not seeing the back of it. He says, in that way, you can never see anything then, right? Because no matter what you perceive, when we're talking about an object in the world, you're never going to perceive the whole thing from all the way around. And so every perception, you'll have to say, every perception is erroneous. We don't accept that, you know? Because we'll say, if I say, you know, this is a cup, you're going to say, you can't tell me, oh, it's not a cup. Why? What do you mean it's not a cup? No, that's erroneous knowledge. Why? You're not seeing the back of it. And if you're not seeing the back of it, you can't say this is a cup. Okay? That's how profound this argument is. Okay, no, but it is really a good argument. But let's look at it in reference to Brahman. Now there's a problem here, though, with Brahman, because Brahman doesn't have any parts. We say what Brahman is just is pure being. It's one without a second, actually. Existence itself doesn't have a right side or left side. It's free from time. It's free from space. It's free from all duality. So Brahman is part free. Right? So there's no possibility of perceiving Brahman except as a whole, right? He says, no, that's not true. He says, niramshasya api, even something that doesn't have any parts, samshitvam, has parts. So he says, there's as though having parts, even for something that doesn't have parts. He says, so how can you say that? Brahman isn't going to all of a sudden have parts. But actually, when you bring into mind, as we'll see in a minute, nitya, okay, this whole creation, right, is nothing but Brahman. This is the vision of the Vedanta. This is Brahman. But we see so many parts. Here, I am an individual, you are an individual, and then there's the rug, there's the space, there's space, air, fire, water, earth, there's all of the individuals in it, there's this whole creation that has infinite parts, right? But what is the vision of the Upanishads is that there is one without a second, there is only one Brahman. It's kind of like if you look at the ocean, we use this example a lot, and you say, oh, look at all of the waves. You know, there's countless number of waves, right? There's a countless number of waves, and all those countless number of waves are all held together in one giant ocean, right? But from another perspective, you know, there are no waves at all. There's only water, right? The waves are mitya, right? Because the waves have no being whatsoever apart from the water. And so now in order to really understand what is the substance there of that ocean, I have to be able to remove the part that is mitya. Remove it in the sense that I have to be able to discern the satyam from the mitya. Right? So here what he's saying is that something can be as though with parts, there can be as though having parts, even for that which has no parts. And what does he mean by that? Vyavartya amsha vibheditaha. From discriminating, from differentiating the umsha, the part, you know, that's going to be discarded in a sense. There's the umsha the part that's going to be let go. So, does everybody see what I'm saying? It's like, if we say that there one Brahman is one without a second, okay, that's one thing. He's going to grow up this just a little bit differently, but let me just do this for him. There's two ways to do it, so I'm going to do it both ways. If we, so take first of all like this. If we say Brahman is, and from Brahman this whole creation has come, right? So now we're experiencing Brahman as this whole creation. But in order to recognize Brahman, which is one without a second, we have to see through the upadhi, right? The upadhi is creating all of the parts. So by discerning Brahman, the existence, differentiated from the upadhi, then we're discarding the upadhi and seeing what actually is. Okay, now look at this. Say it was simple. If I hold up a clay pot, when I hold up a clay pot, you're seeing the clay and the pot. Well, you're seeing both. You're seeing the clay, but you're also seeing the pot. But I can say to you that there is only clay here. You're still seeing the pot, right? If I hold a clay pot, first I say, see, there's clay in pot. And then I say, yes, there's clay. I see the clay. Do you see the pot? Yes, I see the pot. I see the clay in the pot. Right? Then what if I say, but really there's only clay? Right? Now I've discarded the pot without getting rid of the pot. See, if I say there's only clay there, really, will you say yes or no? I say, yeah, there's only clay there in terms of what is actually there. And you see it. You also see the pot, but now the pot has become mitya. Why has the pot become mitya? Because it's not really there. The only thing that's really there is clay in terms of substance. But the pot is there, 100% dependent on the clay, right? So you say, clay and pot? No, not really. There's clay and pot, okay. No, let's not say it that way. Let's say there's a pot is dependent on clay. Now we've brought in the mitya, right? There's a pot, but the pot is dependent on clay. Clay is its truth. Okay, so now we have satyam mitya. The clay is the truth. The pot is mitya. Everybody see that? Because the reality of the pot, what's the reality of the pot? Mitya. Because it really is totally dependent on the clay. So now we're even acknowledging satyam mitya. Then what if I say, you know, we go to a higher level. Okay. What if I say, there's really only clay here? That's right. There is really only clay here. But then, as long as we're experiencing the pot, we have to acknowledge it. Right? But really, there's only clay here. But there's the pot. And the pot enjoys an empirical reality. So here we say, really, there's only Brahman here. There's nothing else. There's no more, there isn't any more thing, universe, creation here than there is a pot to the clay. There's no creation at all that is not Brahman. There is only Brahman here. And you try to find a creation, try to find something here. You can't find anything. The more we can see it, all right. But when you go to find a thing here other than self-evident Brahman, you can't, because everything's infinitely divisible. And so all the only thing that is really here is Brahman. Okay? But to recognize that, you have to differentiate the substance, the sat-chit, from the nama-rupa, from the name and form. Now, okay, so there's that. Everybody see that? So in that way, you're removing the upadhi. This is how the Bhashya is talking about. You're removing the upadhi and revealing the content. There's another way of talking it that we'll get into next week with the next verse. But it is this. The Upanishad unfolds Brahman is, the astitvam, the isness of Brahman. But that isness of Brahman has to be recognized as aparoksha my amness. Brahman is, has to be the isness, the Brahman, the isness, has to be recognized as amness. In fact, there is no isness. There is no such experience of isness. The only experience you have is amness.
Right?
How do you know about isness? What is your experience of isness? There, you can't, you're not looking at it. You're not looking at any isness. You're not looking at any being. I'm talking about the experience of it. The experience of isness is amness. There isn't isness and amness. There's only amness. So actually that really is, if you can kind of play with those two words, isness and amness, then you recognize that it's not isness that this world enjoys, it's amness that this world enjoys. Then you say, I am the whole. It's the very amness that I am that is the amness of the whole. So the self, right, your amness, is the only existent experience that a person has. There is no isness. There's no conversion from amnessness. There's no such thing. Right? There's only amness. And so then if you think, if you recognize your own, the swaprakashita, you know, the self-evident nature of your being, that is as what? It's not I is, it's I am. If we're using language. And then that am, then is it then am or is? Am or is that this world is enjoying? It's am. No, unless you want to say I is. See what I'm saying? There's no am and is. And so now he's going to be dealing with that a little bit. We'll stop here though. Am and is. I am. It am. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Hari Om.
Where did the isness come in?
Because when we say Brahman Asti, and it's going to be part of this part of this argument, but when we did the Paroksha Jnanam and the Aparoksha Jnanam, if you remember the seven stages, he's still going to be building off of these seven stages or these seven different stages that the individual goes through, from ignorance, ajnanam, to avaranam, the covering, to vikshepa, the projection, then to the paroksha jnanam,
you know, the self is, Brahman is, to the aparoksha jnana, I am Brahman, right? So there's is this isness and amness, you know, to Brahman is, when Brahman is, to I am Brahman. That's the, you're going from isness to amness, you know.
It seems like the isness is still pointing to something else.
That's right.
Other than yourself.
Because you, who would say that, you know, that's like the wave saying on the ocean. If you think, you think of Brahman as the infinite self, or say you say, I am Ishvara, and your identification with the is with the jiva. And then you think of the Lord as the, you know, the infinite intelligent being. You can't say, I am Ishvara. So, and so with Brahman, Brahman is, can be translated as the infinite self. So the Atma is the little self, the finite self that the jiva enjoys from the Ajnani position. Here I am the Atma. I am a self. You are an Atma. You are Atma. You are Atma. Brahman is the limitless self. So how can my self, my Atma, be Brahman? That's the question. How can my Atma, this individual self, be Brahman? So another way of phrasing that question, how can the jiva be Ishvara? How can the self that I am be the limitless Brahman? How is that possible? That's what the whole teaching is, to make the individual see that the self that I am is the limitless Brahman. So it'll start out with Brahman is, or God, Ishvara is, or Brahman, the infinite self is, or the infinite Lord is. It's always out there. Is, it is. I am here. Brahman is there. There's a, this huge divide between am and is. I am, you are. I am, he, she, or it is, right? So what has to happen is that the upadhis have to fall off, and then you're left with the am, which is. Right? Because the amness itself is not objectifiable. So the amness of Ishvara is the amness of the jiva. And there you find out, what you recognize is there is nothing but amness. You make up the word is. But that there's no experience of it. There's experience of, in language, of course, there is, because I, through my sense organs, I see objects. I see experience, time and space through my sense organs and all of the objects. That's what I experience. But I don't experience isness as separate from amness. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, a good way to understand this is, say you have an imagination. That's very clear. What I'm talking about is, if you do it in reference to an imagination, like say if I say, okay, imagine a meadow, you're imagining a meadow. It's very clear that the existence of the meadow is your amness. Because that's subjective. You know it's a subjective thought. You know you can, it's very easy for you to discern in just your own subjective thought that it's the amness, the your me-ness, your amness that pervades that thought of the meadow. That there is no isness. You see what I'm saying? That there's just being itself, which is we label as amness. But it's not any different at all. Whether it's a subjective thought of a meadow or a perception of the creation, external creation, there isn't any difference in the experience. Because in either case, being is not an objectifiable. Whether it's not objectifiable in reference to your subjective thought of the meadow, nor is it objectifiable to your perception of the creation. There is no such differentiation there. And then if you go and say, well, yeah, but still, this creation has an objective reality, so it must have something here. And you go and start analyzing it, and you find, no, it doesn't actually. There is no substance here at all. because everything's infinitely divisible. If it comes into being, goes out of being, you can't find anything here. And what doesn't change at all? It's just the being which is the substance of the whole thing. That never changes. And that's actually your experience. So all these words are doing is trying to help you to recognize that the reality of that experience. So the words might sound intellectual, but they're intellectual in the sense that you have to use your mind. But you're using your mind to actually see what's being said, because Brahman is aparoksha, right? Yourself is aparoksha, it's self-evident. That means it's present right here and now. And so these words are just taking your mind and pointing this, trying to make you see. So your mind goes, oh. Your mind's, you know, trying to see it. If your mind's trying to think it, that's a problem. If you're trying to make a theoretical construct out of it, that's a problem. That'll work if, like a theory, you can write a paper on it or something and have it all be logical and all of that. That's fine. But the words, when they're being used as a pramana, as a means of knowledge, these words are trying to make you recognize the experience that's actually here. Like, say, we say just a simple thing, like we say any object that you take is infinitely divisible, and therefore you can't find it, and that goes into an infinite regress. You can never get to the bottom of that. Right? As long as the thing takes up form, takes up space, you can divide it. You know? And as long as it has a form, you can divide it again. It's never going to stop. So it's impossible for you to find a thing here, an object here. And not only that, everything in this creation, it comes from something, goes into something. It has non-existence on either side of it. These are not just words. They're words that are describing a reality that's important for you to see. Now, because it's important for you to see, because unless you can see that, the truth of that, the being, the reality that you're giving to these things remains stuck on them. Right? So you use all of these devices to shed the names and forms of the creation, to help you see through the names and forms of the creation to the changeless being that the creation is enjoying. Right? The creation enjoys changeless being, which is yourself. But the names and forms hide it because you think the changeless being belongs to the names and forms. Then the names and forms die, so the being dies. That's what we think. This body dies, so the being that it enjoys dies. But the being never dies. I am the being that never dies. I'm the changeless being. That's the truth of all of these things. So that, all these words are circling around trying to make the person see it. And the meditations are the same way. The meditations are trying to slow down the teaching. Everything you learn at the time of teaching, the meditations, nididhyasana, is meant to slow that teaching down so you're just sitting there with the fact of it in slow motion. It's like Swamiji's often said nididhyasana is like shravana in slow motion. Right? Because shravana is the unfoldment. So in nididhyasana, in meditation, you take just one little thing and you just stretch it with a lot of silence, you know, pointing, sitting in silence so that your mind just has a chance to get to know it, get to know yourself. That's what the nididhyasana is meant for.
Carol.
Yeah.
Could one actually say then that, you know, any apparent experience of existence, of isness as an objective isness, is actually, you know, it's just putative, it's indirect. That in itself is indirect knowledge, because the only direct knowledge is one's experience of one's amness. Now, is the in any sense of any experience you think you're having that something is
objectively, outside of yourself, is just a reflection of your...
It's not even a reflection. The isness of the experience, even though it's superimposed on the experience, that isness that is superimposed on the experience, like if I say, like this rug is, and the wall is, you are, I'm superimposing existence onto it. But the existence that's being superimposed, being told that I'm saying that it belongs to that object, that is the existence which is Brahman. Mm-hmm. There is no reflection of existence or imagination of existence. There's only one existence.
Right, but I guess what I'm getting at is that the sense, the idea, because people think that they have a direct experience of the existence of something outside of themselves.
Yes.
But that's actually not a direct experience of an existence outside of themselves. It's actually a direct experience of their own existence.
That's right.
So the idea, even when you think you're experiencing something outside of yourself, it's actually, in a sense, it's an indirect knowledge, or it's a conceptual, it's a putative, it's an idea.
Well,
you think you're experiencing something outside of yourself, but you're only actually experiencing one's own.
Your own being.
Your own being.
But, you know, with this, because there's Maya, there's a creation. I mean, I am experiencing your body is different from mine, your clothes, the rug, etc. I'm experiencing all
but
these things.
But beingness is not.
That's right. The beingness is only one. And that beingness itself is what we call self-evident. And so it's self-shining. Right, and so absolutely everything enjoys it, but not as an object, right? That's why I like to use the example of a meadow or an imagination, because in that there is three dimensions. If I paint a picture of a meadow with trees and sky and lawns and mountains and all of this, you have a three-dimensional landscape there, right? And within it, you know, on the right side are the trees, and on the left side is the river, etc. All of that dimension is there. But that all of that dimension enjoys one being, which has no dimension. The being is just the one without a second, which is, from the standpoint of the meadow or the imagination, totally pervasive to the imagination, to every part of the imagination equally. But if I get rid of the imagination, what is left is just pure being that is free from time and space. Because space also is part of the Maya. So here, if you look at this whole creation, let's have the creation just be this room, this entire room with its all its dimensionality, all of the individuals in it, the whole room enjoys existence. And I experience it that way as a jiva looking at another jiva. I say, oh, look, everything it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is. I impute isness on the whole thing. But the isness is not something I'm perceiving. The isness is something that I am. Right? But then it gets projected just in terms of language. But even if I ask you, you're seeing all these names and forms, are you seeing isness? How do you know that all of these things that you're seeing exist? And then, well, look, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is. Everything is. Which is true, right? That in reality, there is nothing away from it. But what is your actual experience of being? It's not something you're looking at. It's the very substrate truth of all experience. And that is you. So that means your body is in this room along with every other body, and the whole room enjoys my being. I'm the whole room. But in terms of the truth of the whole room. So that's why if you think of a meadow or something and go back and forth, you can start to understand, because in reference to your subjective thought or imagination, it's easier to see how you are the whole. Even in that three-dimensional thought. And then go from there to this. In this, what is the difference? The difference is that it's not subjective, but
this body, mind, sense organs is part of this room, and this body, mind, sense organs is included in my perception of the room. Right? And so then think of it like this. Think of it, well, actually, my experience of this room is a vritti, is a thought modification. Even though I'm experiencing it through my sense organs, it's still a thought modification that I'm experiencing. Because remember, if I were daydreaming and my sense organs were open, you know, staring at the room, but I'm daydreaming, where am I? I'm with my daydream. So whatever I'm experiencing right now is a vritti. This room is three-dimensional, but my imagination of the room or imagination of the meadow is three-dimensional also. So then go back and forth. Okay, the meadow? Yeah. That is me. The room? Yeah. That is me. What's the difference? There's no difference. You have to work with that a little bit to see. Then you say, well, now, wait a minute. There's an inside and outside. I mean, you know. You say, no, no, no. You can do that in the dream also. Dream character can do that in the dream, right? And the dream character in the dream can say, don't tell me this isn't real. It is. It's as real as you are. Right? So, if you go back and forth like that, you can start to recognize that yourself is not contained. Your being, the me, it's always the same. Nothing's ever away from it. But it's not trapped or contained anywhere. You know, so go back and forth from the meadow to a room or whatever, to go from, you know, objective reality to subjective reality to objective reality. There is no real objective reality. There is the objective reality in the sense that, you know, I can't make this rug turn into something else. That's what we mean by objective reality. But in terms of your actual experience, what is really the difference between yourself and the imagination of a meadow, which is a vritti, and yourself and the perception of this room, which is a vritti? See what I mean? Both are vrittis. So if you can appreciate the pervasiveness of your being in the meadow imagination, you can appreciate the pervasiveness of your being in the perception, the objective perception of the room, in terms of your own experience. So it's a worthy meditation, you know, like an open-eye meditation, that type of thing. Do you get it, Ben?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Sue?
So I guess I'm just taking another step, because then I'm right there with you, and then I start to think, well, I that's my experience, but then that's your experience too. So how does that work?
That is because, I mean, of course, the vritti will be different.
Yeah.
But the self is only one. So what it means is, I am yourself. There's only one self. And so the self-experience, which is me, the me experience, just pure conscious being, like when I say in the meditation, for instance, you know, just notice who you are. And I used all those words to kind of make you recognize what that self-evident self-experience is. Right? So all these words were pointing to that. That self-experience is its own experience. Right? It's not dependent on a mind. So that self, me, lights up this mind, this mind, this mind, the universe. There aren't two me's. You can say, well, if there aren't two me's, how can I be me and you be me? Well, it's because the me belongs to me. The me belongs to consciousness itself.
Oh, so it's no longer my me.
No, the me that you think is my me is the me, of the consciousness. Right? Consciousness is its own experience. And so this consciousness, even if you get rid of the whole universe, get rid of the entire universe and all beings, everything, all Maya, just get rid of the whole thing, what is left? Me. Because
the me experience, the self, the I, these are just words pointing to the who I am. That belongs to the conscious being. And so that is you. But that is me too. That's why I know you completely, because I am you. Your mind is different. My mind is different. Body is different. Sense organs are different. That's all part of the Maya. So now, that's why I say again, if you go into the imagination of, say, a meadow that has animals in it and people, and say you take a form in the meadow and you're walking with friends, then you can easily understand, yeah, the self that my friend is enjoying and the self that I am enjoying, the self that the animals are enjoying, the self that the whole is enjoying, is just me. There's only me there. And then this friend says, no, I am me. And this friend says, no, I am me. And the animals say, well, I'm me, I'm me, I'm me. And then Ishwara says, I am me. Actually, right? But there's only one me. That's Advaita, that, and I am that. Amazing.
Seems like there's so many ways to mistake that me also.
Oh, it's endless.
Yeah.
From the standpoint, because all of your means of knowledge, you know, and having a body, mind, sense organs, only... they're only able to see and experience name and form, not the self of the name and form. Because sense organs are all looking outward, you know? Alrighty.
I like the satsang better than the verses.
So those last couple of verses were a little hard. I'll make it more clear next week.
Okay, good. Yeah.